Philippians 1:12-18. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel, so that it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. And most of the brothers, having become confident in the Lord by my imprisonment, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ from envy and rivalry, but others from goodwill. The latter do it out of love, knowing that I am put here for the defense of the gospel. The former proclaim Christ out of selfish ambition, not sincerely, but thinking to afflict me in my imprisonment. What then? Only that, in every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is proclaimed, and in that I rejoice.
Hey, good morning. Happy Sunday to you. Before we dig into Philippians chapter 1, just a couple of quick updates about other things going on. One of them relates to our friends in Cambodia. You know, most of you know we have this partnership with an organization called Jumpa Ministries. They are rooted in a village called Soban, just outside of Phnom Penh in Cambodia. They do a lot of wonderful things. Probably the largest scale thing they do is a school that they run that serves several hundred kids. And we sent a whole team of people from Redeemer over there last summer to serve those kids and also to start meeting some of the teachers and to figure out how we can build this partnership with them over time. We're exploring this exciting question with them of how we can help them plant a church there in the village of Soban, where there are believers, people who believe in Jesus Christ, people whose lives have been changed by the gospel of Jesus Christ, but no gathering of a church for them to partner or participate in. And so there's a lot of exciting things happening there. We heard, though, recently that with the COVID-19 crisis that the whole world is dealing with right now, the students connected with their school are not participating in the same way they have been participating, and therefore there is a very large financial shortfall. They do ask for some tuition from the families that send their kids to that school, and as a result, they're looking at being about $20,000 short this year in being able to pay their teachers. As we learned about this as elders, as leaders at this church, our hearts were kind of tugged in the direction of saying, how can we be generous? How can we help? And we don't have the answers to all of those questions yet. We're still figuring it out. We're still praying about it. We're still thinking about it. There is some information already on our website about that. And I think yesterday, if you checked the email, if you get Redeemer News, there's a little bit of info connected there about it. But I just kind of want to invite you to be praying and be thinking and be getting excited about how we can partner in generosity with the brothers and sisters there and the good gospel work that they're doing. So that's one of the things. The second one is that we also just found out from our partners here in Aurora, our partners at World Relief. World Relief is a great organization. It does a lot of good things to serve vulnerable people around the world here in Aurora. They're particularly involved with refugee resettlement and helping immigrants get connected in Aurora. And we just heard that with the end of the school year coming up, a lot of students who have come from other countries are struggling to make it through the finish line here. Even some of the graduating seniors or seniors who are supposed to be graduating are struggling to get through the finish line of this school year. And so we found out there is a greater need right now for people who can volunteer as tutors, which just means getting on a Zoom call, maybe with a junior higher or a high schooler once a week or maybe a few times a week for the next few weeks. And so if you're able to serve in that way, maybe contact Josh Anderson if you would. And I would just love to flood them with a whole army of Redeemer volunteers who are ready and eager to go and demonstrate the love of Christ in that way. And I know you're eager for those things as well. So just a couple things I wanted to mention. And now we're going to turn our attention to the book of Philippians, that passage that was read in Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 18. Keep that open if you would, because we're going to look at it. We're doing a sermon series through the book of Philippians right now. We're calling this sermon series In This Together. We're talking about how the gospel, how to live in a manner worthy of the gospel, or how to live in a manner that is fitting with or shaped by the gospel of Jesus Christ. We just get that from a phrase that Paul uses in Philippians chapter 1, verse 27. Last week, we talked about gospel-shaped joy. And this week, it kind of continues in that theme of joy, except in a really particular way. As Paul continues to write this letter to the church in the city of Philippi about 2,000 years ago, as he continues to write this letter, after talking about the joy and his gratefulness and his glad-hearted praying for the church, he goes into a report about his own circumstances and a report about his perspective of his own circumstances. And so what we're going to talk about today is gospel-shaped perspective. Paul David Tripp has been a pastor and a professional counselor and a professor and an author and a popular speaker. Maybe you've heard of him before. He has a good book on suffering. And in his book on suffering, here's one of the little insights that he drops for us. He says, as people made in God's image, none of us live our lives based on the raw facts of our experiences alone. We all live based on our particular interpretation of those facts. You see the difference? Paul Tripp is not at all saying that our experiences don't matter. That's not what he's saying. That's not what I would want to say. That's not what the Bible teaches. It's not saying that our experiences don't matter. But what he's pointing out is that along with our experiences, something that vitally shapes our lives and vitally shapes our emotions and our choices and what we do with our lives is not just what happens to us, but how we interpret what happens to us, right? Let's just take for a second the example of two people who have both been given the exact same diagnosis of terminal cancer. One of those people might be living their lives in grief and sadness and sorrow and bitterness and resentment about how their years have been cut short. And the other person, remember, with the exact same terminal diagnosis, really might live their days out with this kind of vibrant, vivacious joy and gratefulness for every last day that they get to be alive, right? We've probably all seen this, right? Let me give you another example. I grew up in Southern California, mainly in the city of San Diego. And most of you are thinking right now, they have really nice weather there. You're right, they have really nice weather in San Diego. But I want to tell you something that I have observed from living about half my life in Southern California and about half my life in Illinois. You want to know a secret? People in California complain about the weather more than people in Illinois complain about the weather, right? It's totally true. I haven't done like the scientifically verifiable research about this, but based on my observations, it's totally true. Why? Because it's not just our experiences that shape us, it's our interpretation of our experiences. And if you live your whole life in sunny Southern California, you get used to expecting every day to be sunny by 10 a.m. And if it's not sunny till 11, that's something to gripe about even on January 15th, right? And so, what I'm saying here is there are two things that matter: what happens, but also, and perhaps especially, how we interpret what happens to us. Even if you're not a believer in Jesus, I think you could probably come this far with me in realizing that there is a difference between what happens and how we interpret what happens. And these things both are very important for how we end up living our lives, right? Well, in our passage for today, we're going to hear a testimony from somebody who lived through very difficult circumstances and yet was characterized by gratefulness, joy, and rejoicing. And what we're going to pay attention to, especially today, is his perspective, the example of Christian perspective, the example of how the gospel can shape a perspective here from this passage. Now, by the way, this is not everything that the book of Philippians has to say about suffering. This is not everything that Paul has to say about suffering. This is not everything the Bible has to say about suffering. I want to be very clear about that up front. But we're going to get one example of how the gospel can shape our perspective, even in very difficult times. And so here's what I want to talk about. I want to talk first about what happened. And then I want to talk about how Paul interpreted what happened. And then I want to give you a couple of kind of concrete suggestions for us today. Okay? So first of all, we'll talk about what happened. In verse 12 of chapter 1 in Philippians, Paul mentions, quote, what has happened to me. Now, the church in Philippi knew about what had happened to him. They sent a letter to him expressing their grief over it. They sent some financial resources to help support him there. They sent Epaphroditus, a messenger from their church, to comfort and encourage Paul in these difficult circumstances. They were very aware of what had happened to Paul. We might not be quite as aware. And so before I dig into Paul's interpretation, I want to spend a few minutes and just kind of set the scene by talking about what happened to Paul. You could go and read about it in Acts chapter 21, all the way through Acts chapter 28. What's happened to Paul? The story begins with advice from a Christian friend. More specifically, advice from a Christian friend that did not work out very well. So Paul was in Jerusalem, and he is visiting with his friend James, who is a leader of the church in Jerusalem. And James warns Paul, a lot of people here are out to get you. They're really upset about you. And so James gives Paul some advice that he thinks will help. Paul, why don't you purify yourself according to a Jewish custom and then go to the temple according to that same custom to show people that you're not opposed to the Jewish people and their customs, right? And so Paul, the Bible says a wise man listens to advice. Proverbs 12:15, Paul does the wise thing. He listens to James's advice. He goes, he starts this purification ritual. He goes to the temple. And while he's there in the temple, things go really sideways, really fast. A whole riot kind of erupts because people are making accusations about Paul. A Roman soldier has to ride in and kind of try to break things up, but it's so chaotic, he can't even figure out what's going on. So he just figures, if I arrest this guy, maybe that will help calm things down for today. So they arrest Paul there on the spot in the city of Jerusalem. And here's the thing, because Paul listened to the advice of his Christian friend James and went to the temple that day, the next 5 years of his life are going to get eaten up in a legal battle related to being arrested in the temple in Jerusalem when the guy who arrested him didn't even know who he was. In fact, it's kind of funny in Acts chapter 21, the guy who arrested him thinks he's an Egyptian guy who's there for a completely different reason. He doesn't even know who he's talking to at that point. But this whole story of Paul's suffering and trials, it all begins with advice from a Christian friend. And when we get advice from a friend and it doesn't go so well, what happens to us? Well, how do we respond to that? Very often we respond to advice that doesn't work out so well. We respond to that with regret, with resentment, with blaming, with grumbling about that person who gave us that advice. Those are very normal ways to respond when we get bad advice from a Christian friend, or from any friend for that matter. But all of that simply makes Paul's response even more remarkable. That's just the beginning of what went wrong. The advice that he received from a Christian opened the door for unfair accusations from enemies of Christianity. What came next was this whole slew of unfair accusations. Beginning that fateful day in Jerusalem, and in trial after trial, enemies of Christianity show up with these bogus charges that they're throwing at Paul. For example, in one of those trials, they come and they say he needs to be punished because he brought an Ephesian guy, a foreigner. He brought a foreigner into the temple. And this was almost true because Paul did bring an Ephesian friend of his to the city of Jerusalem. He didn't bring him into the temple. And so these unfair accusations just keep getting brought up over and over and over again. And it's a painful thing if you've ever experienced it. It's a very painful thing if you've ever experienced it, to be unfairly accused, to be charged with something that you didn't do, or to be charged with something that's only partially accurate, whether that's from a friend or in a court of law. It's a very difficult thing to persevere. And when we find ourselves unfairly characterized or unfairly charged or unfairly accused by enemies of Christianity, it would be so easy for someone like Paul to say, those people are hateful, those people are wrong, those people are messed up. And yet that only makes Paul's response to this situation even more remarkable. His interpretation is not consumed with bitterness toward the enemies who have falsely accused him. These unfair accusations, though, are still not the end of the story. The unfair accusations lead to Paul getting caught up in a horribly inefficient government process. That is probably an understatement. trial after trial, year after year, Paul is traveling from place to place, first in Jerusalem, Caesarea. Eventually, he appeals to the emperor and travels to Rome for his case to be heard, all because he was arrested, not even knowing who he was, in the temple in Jerusalem on that fateful day. 5 years later, he's still dealing with this headache of a situation because of this inefficient government legal judicial process that's carrying on and on and on and on. And it would be so easy in that situation to blame and complain, wouldn't it? If they could just get their act together, we could have had all this stuff solved years ago and I'd have my freedoms back. So easy to blame and complain, and yet that makes Paul's interpretation of this situation even more remarkable, doesn't it? It makes his interpretation breathtaking. Well, this horribly inefficient process by the government led to a near-death shipwreck. We read about this at the beginning of, or in Acts chapter 27. Paul was being transferred from his trial in Caesarea to his trial in Rome. And en route, what happens? This violent storm comes. We would call it an act of God. An act of God comes and makes it impossible for the ship to make it in Rome. In fact, the ship shipwrecks or crashes into a reef in the Mediterranean Sea. There's a guy walking around the ship, a Roman soldier, looking for any prisoners so he can kill them on the spot so that he's not responsible for losing any prisoners in this way. Yet Paul survives this near-death experience in the middle of an act of God. He lands on the island of Malta. Now that sounds really cool for a second, right? Because some days I would not mind a vacation at the beach, right? I wouldn't mind getting caught on the Mediterranean Sea for a little while, right? That wouldn't be too bad, we think, right? But Paul's experience was no beachfront vacation. For example, one of the things we read about in the book of Acts is that while he's there on the island of Malta, that he sees a snake. I don't like snakes very much. I don't know about you. I might not be quite as freaked out as Indiana Jones, but I think most of us have a little bit of that thing in us. We don't like those serpents, right? And this serpent comes and it bites Paul. And the locals who know the snakes and know the effects of this kind of snake bite, they think Paul is as good as dead at this point, right? And yet, all of this makes Paul's interpretation of these circumstances even more remarkable, right? All of this leads to 2 years of house arrest in the city of Rome. He's imprisoned, he's treated like a prisoner, but he's not considered a flight risk, and so they allow him, as long as he can pay for his own expenses, as long as he can pay for the rent for the house he's going to rent, as long as he can pay for his own meals, he's allowed to live with a little bit of freedom there in the city of Rome. That's indicated by Acts chapter 28, verse 30. But here's the thing. There's one huge qualification of his freedom there in the city of Rome. He is chained the entire time to a member of the Roman Imperial Guard. And so day after day, shift after shift, these guards come and link themselves to Paul, and he is stuck there under the watch of the Imperial Guard day after day for year after year. 2 whole years of this stuff, it continues. 5 years from the ordeal in Jerusalem until the day when he is finally set free in Rome. That's what has happened that Paul is referring to in Philippians chapter 1, verse 12. But what's remarkable is not so much what happened. What's remarkable is Paul's interpretation of what has happened. Notice what Paul interprets. His interpretation is not resentment toward James. Look, I just got some bad advice here. His interpretation is not bitterness toward the enemies of Christianity. There are hateful and venomous people. No, his interpretation of the facts is not grumbling about the government. If they just got their act together, I could be through with all of this by now. His interpretation of the facts is not God hates me, and that's why this act of God must have fallen upon me. His interpretation of the facts is not that Satan has won a great victory here. His interpretation of the facts is not, look, I just need this headache to end so that I can finally get back to life as normal. No, notice with me Paul's profound interpretation of his circumstances in verse 12. Look there with me if you would. I want you to know, brothers, that what has happened to me has really served to advance the gospel. Paul's interpretation of his circumstances is governed by his connection with the gospel. Everything he sees in life, he sees through the lens of the gospel of Jesus Christ. Maybe you've heard of the famous book by Rabbi Kushner, which is called When Bad Things Happen to Good People. Similarly, we might call this passage a description of when bad things happen to gospel people. When bad things happen to gospel representing people. And what this passage shows us through Paul's example is that when bad things happen to gospel people, a door can open for the advance of the unstoppable gospel. And if we're gospel people, then that is reason to rejoice. That's what this passage shows us. In this passage, Paul shows us three specific ways that the gospel message advanced through his hardships. I'll take just a minute and show you each of them. A first way that the unstoppable gospel advanced was in reaching new people. Look with me if you would at verse 13. So, as a result, it has become known throughout the whole imperial guard and to all the rest that my imprisonment is for Christ. So here's Paul. He's chained to these members of the imperial guard. These are kind of elite soldiers, kind of a cross between army rangers and secret service agents. They work directly for Caesar. They were often charged with protecting Caesar's life. They were in charge of protecting Caesar's city, and they were charged with protecting or guarding or watching over people who had come to appeal directly to Caesar while they were in town. These were people who often went on to become influencers in society. They often, after they kind of retired from their work in the Imperial Guard or the Praetorium, they would often go on to become wealthy influencers in Roman society. This was a very strategic group of people, and one after another keeps coming into Paul's house, and they keep getting chained up. And as Don Sanukian points out, it wasn't just that Paul was chained to them, it's that they were chained to Paul. And so Paul points out, yeah, I'm here in chains, but as I'm here in chains, these very chains give an opportunity for the gospel to get shared. And so you can kind of imagine the scene. Here comes the guard named Marcus, and he comes in and changes out the chains with the guy who's getting off his shift. Maybe that guy rolls his eyes. Maybe that guy is crying. Maybe that guy is happy. I have no idea, but last guard goes, and now Marcus comes, and he's chained to Paul. Paul says, Marcus, it's good to see you again. Welcome. I'm so glad you're here. How's your family, Marcus? Good. How's your wife? So glad to hear it. Marcus, I really appreciated last time you were over here. I spent a lot of time listening to your own view about the Roman gods. And I was very impressed at how pious you are. Maybe I have my prejudices, but I have to say I was kind of surprised, Marcus, to hear from a soldier such deep reflections about spiritual matters. But Marcus, while you're here today, my friend Epaphroditus is here, and we were just talking about the Lord Jesus Christ. I don't know how much you've heard about Jesus. You've probably heard there's a lot of buzz about him all around town. He's the guy who was crucified in Jerusalem a few years ago. Many of the Jewish people think that he was crucified as the Messiah to rescue us from our sins. And here's the thing, Marcus. After he was crucified, he was raised again in new life. There was a Roman soldier guarding his tomb. Marcus, you know as well as anybody, three grieving women or five grieving women can't overpower a Roman soldier, right, Marcus? Well, here's the thing. There was a Roman soldier charged with making sure no one came to steal the body, but that grave is empty today, Marcus. And I used to be an opponent of the message about Jesus Christ. I used to live my life trying to stop this whole Christianity thing. But I'm here to tell you today, Marcus, I believe that Jesus was raised from the dead. because he is the Christ. He is the Son of God. He really did give himself as a sacrifice for our sins, and he rose again in new life so that people like me and people like you can have new life with him forever, because he's coming back again. And he's coming back again, and on that day, he'll make an enemy. He'll make his enemies to be like a footstool before his feet. But on that day, every knee will bow and every knee will recognize that Jesus is the King of Kings, that he is the Lord of Lords, that he is the name above all names, and it will be recognized that salvation is found in no one else. Marcus, I know that you're a very devout man, but I'd like to talk with you today about trusting in Jesus Christ and giving your allegiance to him. Well, who knows how Marcus responded, but after one soldier after another gets chained to Paul in his household, Paul is able to report the gospel is reaching new people on account of these difficult circumstances that I'm going through. And that leads to a second thing that Paul notices, a second way that the unstoppable gospel is advancing. It's not just that more people are being reached, it's also that through his hardship, the unstoppable gospel is advancing by giving others courage to speak about Christ. More people in the city of Rome were courageous to speak about Christ as a result of Paul's imprisonment. This might seem counterintuitive at first. You might think, wait a second, if Paul was in prison and representing Jesus, isn't that going to make other people scared of representing Jesus? It didn't work out that way in Paul's lifetime. And in fact, it didn't work out that way very often in the last 2,000 years. It's often said that the blood of the martyrs is the seed of the church. One church leader from the second century who saw a great deal of persecution in the Roman Empire himself, a guy named Tertullian, was giving an explanation or a defense of the Christian faith before some people who didn't believe it. And he said, "We spring up in greater numbers the more we are mown down by you. The blood of the Christians is the seed of a new life." Every time a Christian gives his or her life on account of the faith, Tertullian is saying, their blood, it waters the soil. And the result is that more women and more men and more young people and more old people and more Jews and more Greeks and more people from various ethnicities and more people from various places in society are going to just keep coming to know Jesus. Paul's experience was not yet an experience of being persecuted to the point of death. He would end there eventually. But already he saw this emboldening effect of the gospel. As he was persecuted, other Christians became more and more courageous in spreading the message of Christ. Suffering Christians can have this effect of shining brightly in dark places. It leads to this question: how true and how beautiful and how life-giving must the message of the gospel be if Paul is literally willing to give up his freedoms and his joys and his very life for the sake of this message? How beautiful and how life-giving and how true must this message be if Paul is willing to lay down his own life on account of it? That question must have had an effect in the city of Rome. That question was meant to have an effect in the city of Philippi. That question may need to have a fresh effect in our hearts today as well. Paul also notices a third way that the unstoppable gospel advances even in his challenging situations. He notices that the gospel advances even through those who are proclaiming the gospel with bad motives. That's what verses 15 through 18 are about. Paul describes a couple different groups of people. One group of people, so he just mentioned in the previous paragraph, people who are more bold to speak about Christ right now. He mentions one group of people who are proclaiming the gospel, the good news about Jesus, and they're proclaiming the message, they're trying to reach others, and they do it out of goodwill for Paul. They love him. They want to see the message he was proclaiming going forward. But Paul speaks of another group of people as well. This one's a little more surprising. He speaks of another group of people in the city of Rome who have seen Paul being persecuted for the faith, and they're now more bold to preach on account of Christ, but they're not bold because they love Paul and they want to see that same message going forward. They're filled with rivalry, envy. These are selfish people. Their motives are rotten at the core. Their message is still a message about Christ. Their gospel is still the gospel. Otherwise, Paul would be correcting them quite clearly over this. But Paul says, listen, even if they're going around trying to become the next Paul, even if they're going around with self-inflated motives, even if they're going around with an overly inflated sense of themselves, here's how I view it, Paul says. Christ is being proclaimed, and for that I rejoice. Now, if Paul had a chance to meet with those people, I bet that he would want to talk with them about their heart-level motives, just like he's going to address issues like selfishness and rivalry and envy in Philippians chapter 2. We'll be reading about that in just a few weeks. But having said that, for us today, it's worth pausing and recognizing this beautiful example that Paul sets. Even if people are making much of Christ and thinking little of us, we can rejoice because Christ is being proclaimed. It's a powerful example. All of that is Paul's explanation of what happens when bad things happen to gospel people. When bad things happen to gospel-representing people, doors open for the unstoppable message of the gospel to continue to go forward. And if the message of the gospel is what we love, then that is reason to rejoice. Let's consider a few kind of specific implications for our lives today, here in our city and in our world in 2020. Here's a first suggestion that grows out of Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 18. Let's consider how the gospel of Jesus Christ can help us interpret our experiences. As we see this example of how Paul interpreted his experience through a gospel lens, it challenges us to consider, well, what lens do I use to interpret my circumstances, right? It leads to a moment of reflection about that. For some of us, in order to interpret life through the lens of the gospel, that needs to begin simply by embracing the message of the gospel itself. The message of the gospel tells us that in love, Jesus came and he gave himself for us, and he rose again in new life so that by faith, we can believe in him. And by faith and by believing in him, we are promised eternal life with him. A life, the life that we were meant to live, secured for us through Jesus Christ. That's what the gospel offers to us. And perhaps some of you today, even right now, you need to embrace the gospel, maybe for the first time. Maybe you need to embrace the gospel by turning away from all of the other things in our lives that are bound to disappoint us. And there are so many other things that are bound to disappoint us, right? If we put our hope in money, money's going to go up and money's going to go down. And with it, our joy will go up and our joy will go down. If we put our hope in work and in work circumstances, work is going to go well, sometimes it's not going to go as well others, and with it will go our joy up and down. If we put our hope in politicians, they are bound to disappoint us at one point or another. If we put our hope in circumstances will not be an endless progression from happy to happier and from better to better. They will go up sometimes and they will go down others. In a life with so many messages that leave us just plain empty and disappointed, what good news it is to hear about the hope that is found in Jesus Christ. A foundation that is secure from now until forevermore. I want to invite you even today, just as some of those Roman guards did, and just as Saul of Tarsus did, just as I have, and just as so many other millions of people around the world have, I would love to invite you today to embrace the message of the gospel and encounter and enjoy that security that is found in knowing Him. That, maybe that for you is the first step toward learning to interpret your circumstances in light of the gospel. Maybe for others of us here, we need to learn to interpret our circumstances in light of the gospel simply by recognizing that the gospel is not just a message of fire insurance for the last day. It's not just a message that gives us a key into heaven out there somewhere someday. The gospel is a message that is meant to shape and shade and interpret how we experience all of life, even times of suffering. And so I want to invite you and encourage you to consider, how does the gospel of Jesus Christ help you interpret your own experience today? A second suggestion I want to make from Philippians 1, 12 through 18 is this. Let's consider what gospel opportunities may be open for us right now. Let's have our eyes open to consider what gospel opportunities the Lord may be opening. As Paul explained all of this to the church in Philippi, I'm sure there was a little bit in the church in Philippi that was just like, I'm glad to hear that Paul is doing well. I'm glad to hear he's still rejoicing. I'm glad to hear how the gospel is going forward there in that city. I'm glad to hear how other people there are becoming more bold for the sake of the gospel. But I'm also betting something more happened in the church in Philippi. As they heard this report about Paul's joy in the midst of suffering, as they heard the report about other people becoming more bold to proclaim the name of Christ, I bet there was something rising up in them saying, I want to be more bold in representing Jesus too. And as God's Spirit speaks to us through His Word today, this is one of the things that I think God's Spirit is after. He gives us this passage to speak to us and to strengthen us and to stir in us a greater confidence and a greater boldness for the sake of Jesus Christ. Come what may, regardless of the cost, it gives us a greater sense of courage in representing Jesus and in talking about Him wherever we may be. And so perhaps there may be even some surprising doors that the Lord wants to open up in the circumstances that you're going to be in this week. So maybe there will be circumstances where the Lord will open doors with neighbors. Maybe neighbors you talk to all the time. Maybe neighbors you don't talk to you so often, but you may get some fresh opportunities to interact with them in this unique season that we're in. Keep your eyes open for how the Lord may be opening gospel opportunities right in your own neighborhood. Maybe the Lord will open doors of gospel opportunity with your housemates, or with people that you're living with, or with family members who may call you more regularly than they normally do. Maybe the Lord is using this specific time in your life to open doors for the sake of the gospel. Maybe there is an open door simply related to a family that you have known in the past through World Relief. Or maybe God will open a door through tutoring with World Relief. Maybe God will open a door to reach back out to someone that you've ministered to in the last few years and just reach out in this hard time and say, how are you doing in this challenging, crazy, weird season that we're living through? I care about you. I've had you on my mind. How are you doing? Maybe the Lord will use that to open doors. Listen, even in challenging circumstances, when bad things happen to gospel people, God often opens up doors for the advance of the unstoppable gospel. His Spirit is opening doors. The question is this: are our eyes noticing them? Are we on the lookout for them? And so let me encourage you from this passage to keep your eyes open for how God may be opening doors for the advance of the gospel. And finally, a third takeaway I want to suggest is this: let's live out of a conviction about the power of the gospel message in our city and in our world today. Let's live out of conviction about the power of the unstoppable gospel message. You know, the gospel of Jesus Christ was not stopped by Paul's sufferings. And the same is true today. No amount of suffering, no amount of hardship, no amount of persecution can stop the gospel of Jesus Christ. Let me share with you one illustration of that. I've mentioned before the story of Andrew and Noreen Brunson. They're graduates of Wheaton College. They moved to the nation of Turkey out of love for the people there in that nation. And Andrew began planting a congregation in the nation, a Christian church in the nation of Turkey. And then in 2016, just a few years ago, Andrew was arrested arrested by the government in Turkey. In fact, he spent 3 years under arrest, much of that time without even any charges laid out against him. 3 years he was arrested and held by the Turkish government because he represented Jesus Christ. Only relatively recently was Andrew released and allowed to come back to the United States. I bring up that little story of Andrew's persecution there in Turkey because I just read something within the last month. Just read something within the last month from the Voice of the Martyrs publication about how the gospel is advancing today in the nation of Turkey. One church planter they asked believers to pray for has planted 3 Christian churches in the last 3 years. The first congregation he planted began with 10 members, 10 Christians, and they began talking with people who were kind of disillusioned with their Muslim faith, disillusioned with Islam. And now that church, only 3 years later, has grown from 10 people to 100 believers. And he planted another church last year, and he just planted another church in another city, which now has 20 believers gathering to worship Jesus in it. And as I read this account of what's going on there in the nation of Turkey right now, I just realized afresh the power of the gospel, and it brought joy to my heart. I began to realize that you can expel preachers of the gospel, but you can't expel the gospel. That gets me excited. I began to realize you can chain and imprison missionaries, but you can't chain up the message of Jesus. You can lock up Christians, but you cannot stop the gospel of Jesus Christ. And this is as true today in our city and in our world as it has ever been in the history of the church. The message of Jesus Christ, carried forward by the power of His Spirit, is unstoppable. And here's the thing. If you are a person whose life has been transformed by the hope that's found in Jesus Christ, and if you've trusted in that message, and if you are living for the gospel of Jesus Christ, then this is your joy. All kinds of other things might go well or might go poorly. We might abound financially or we might be in need financially. We might find ourselves in hardships like getting bad advice from friends that doesn't work out so well. We might find ourselves being in some minor ways compared with Paul's experience, but maybe in some small ways being harassed on account of our faith in Jesus Christ. We may find ourselves surrounded by government inefficiencies of all sorts. We may find ourselves living through things that otherwise might just be labeled as an act of God. We might find that the serpent, the old serpent from the garden, is indeed out to get us. We may find all kinds of other hardships, and maybe some of those will stretch on for years, feeling like they're stretching on without relief. But here's the thing. If our joy is with Jesus Christ, and if His message is unstoppable, then we have a reason to rejoice right now in our city, in our world today. And we have a reason to rejoice that is unstoppable because He is unstoppable. And His gospel message is unstoppable. Here's the message of Philippians chapter 1, verses 12 through 18 for us today. It tells us that, yes, bad things will happen to gospel people. But when bad things happen to gospel people, God will use that to open doors for the advance of the unstoppable gospel. And if our joy is hitched up with that gospel message, then that is reason for you and me to rejoice right now, today, and throughout this week, and all the way until our Lord Himself returns. Amen.